This is Una Scarfe, reading on August 6th, 1986, from a novel called Obasan, Joy Kogawa, a Canadian novel of a third generation Canadian who is writing of the experience of the Japanese in Canada in the 1940s, those of Japanese ancestry. And we're reading from Aunt Emily's journal initially. The first entry is dated December 25th, 1941. Thank God we live in a democracy and not under an officially racist regime. All of us Nisi is second generation. All of us Nisi are intent on keeping faith and standing by. We were turned down for the home defense training plan, but we're doing Red Cross work, buying war savings bonds, logging for the war industries and shipyards, benefit concerts, that regular stuff. There have been the usual letters to the editor in the papers. Nonsense, some of them. The majority are decent, however. The RCMP are on our side. More than anyone else, they know how blameless we are. When the city fathers proposed canceling all our business licenses, and remember, this is December, end of December 41, things are moving very fast already. When they proposed canceling all our business licenses, they said we did not rate such harsh treatment. Isn't that encouraging? But now the North Vancouver Board of Trade has gone on record to demand that all our autos be confiscated. What would doctors like Dad and the businessmen do? There was one friendly letter in the province paper protesting the taking away of the right to earn a living from 1,800 people, and the licenses have been suspended for various industries. But then there was another letter by a woman saying she didn't want her own precious daughter to have to go to school with the you-know-whos. Strange how these protesters are so much more vehement about Canadian-born Japanese than they are about German-born Germans. I guess it's because we look different. What it boils down to is an undemocratic racial antagonism, which is exactly what our democratic country is supposed to be fighting against. Oh well, the Eggman told me not to worry. This is still December. But worse than my irritation, there's the horrible feeling whenever I turn on the radio or see a headline with the word Jap screaming at us. So long as they designate the enemy by that term and not us, it doesn't matter. But over here they say, once a Jap, always a Jap, and that means us. We are the enemy. And what about you over there in Tokyo? Have they arrested you because you're a Canadian? If only you'd been able to get out before all this started. If there was some way of getting news from you. And then in February 1942, things are changing so fast. First, all the Japanese men, the ones who were born in Japan and haven't been able to get their citizenship yet, are being rounded up, 100 or so at a time. And then March 42. All student nurses have been fired from the general hospital. Our beautiful radios are gone. We had to give them up or suffer the humiliation of having them taken forcibly by the RCMP. Our cameras, even Stephen's toy one that he brought out to show them when they came, all are confiscated. They can search our homes now without warrant. But the great shock is this. We are all being forced to leave, all of us. Not a single person of the Japanese race who lives in the protected area of Vancouver will escape. And I think I should give you the names of the two children now, who were young, and you can see the face of the child in the front, and that's Naomi, the narrator, and her brother Stephen. You can see his radio, it's just a camera that's just been confiscated. And but right now you're hearing the aunt's diary. A curfew that applies only to us was started a few days ago. If we're caught out after sundown, we're thrown in jail. People who have been fired, and there's a scramble on to be the first to kick us out of jobs, sit at home without even being able to go out for a consoling cup of coffee. Signs have been posted on all highways. Japs, keep out. Mind you, you can't compare this sort of thing to anything that happens in Germany. That country is openly totalitarian. But isn't Canada supposed to be a democracy? And this theme runs through her journal, the comparison. In March of 42, I'm in a daze this morning. The last ruling forbids any of us, even Nisi, and she keeps holding on to this, second generation Canadian, to go anywhere in this wide dominion without a permit from the Minister of Justice through Austin C. Taylor of the Commission. We can only go where they send us. The worse the news from the Eastern Front, the more ghoulish the public becomes. This is a stab. This is a miracle. We are the billy goats and nanny goats and kids, all the scapegoats to appease this blindness. Is this a Christian country? Do you know that Alderman Wilson, the man who says such damning things about us, has a father who is an Anglican clergyman? I can't imagine how the government is going to clothe and educate our young when they can't even get started on feeding or housing 22,000 removees. Yet the deadline for clearing us out seems to be July 1st or the 31st, and that's 1942. End of March. I don't know if you will see any of this. I don't know anything anymore. Things are swiftly getting worse. Vancouver, the water, the weather, the beauty, this paradise is filled up and overflowing with hatred. If we stick around too long, we'll all be chucked into Hastings Park. Fumi and Aiko are helping the women there, and they say the crowding, the noise, the confusion is chaos. Mothers are prostrate in nervous exhaustion, the babies crying endlessly, the fathers torn from them without farewells, everyone crammed into two buildings like so many pigs, children taken out of school with no provision for future education, more and more people pouring into the park, forbidden to step outside the barbed wire gates and fence, the men can't even leave the building, police guards around them. Some of them fight their way out to come to town to see what they can do about their families, babies and motherless children totally stranded. I'm consulting with Dad and Mark and Oba-san about going to Toronto. We could all stay together if we could find someone in Toronto to sponsor us. People are stranded here and there all over the BC interior. I want to leave this poison province. But Oba-san wants to stay in BC to be closer to Sam. I'm going to write to a doctor in Toronto that Dad knows. My 26th birthday is coming up soon and I feel 50. I've got lines under my eyes and my back is getting stooped, I noticed in a shop window today. A few days ago, and this is April now, a few days ago the newspaper reported Ian McKenzie is saying, the intention of the government is that every single Japanese, man, woman, and child, shall be removed from Canada, from Vancouver as speedily as possible. He said we were all going to be out in 3 or 4 weeks and added it was his personal intention, as long as he was in public life, that these Japanese shall not come back here. And then the end of April. All cards and letters are censored, even to the Nisi camps. Not a word from the camps makes the papers. Everything is hushed up. I haven't been to meetings for so long now that I don't know what's going on. Sam's camp, and from the relatives, is 8 miles from the station, up in the hills. Every time a train passes with a new batch of men, they hang from the windows and ask about their families. Sam said he wept. The men are luckier than the women. It's true they are forced to work on the roads, but at least they're fed and they have no children to look after. Of course, the fathers are worried, but it's the women who are burdened with all the responsibility of keeping what's left of the family together. And then in May, Oba-san, the kids, Dad and I have decided to go to Slocum. We hear that's one of the best of the ghost towns, and they're taking them into the abandoned towns in the interior of Alberta here. It used to have a silver mine or maybe a gold mine, I'm not sure. They are just abandoned old hotels there now and a few stores. I don't know the size of the white population, but it's not very large. The family, our family, or what's left of it, intends to stick together one way or another. And after days and nights of discussion, worrying, figuring, indecision, we finally realize the only thing to do is to give in and stay together wherever we go, and moving to Slocum in Alberta is the easiest. Now that the decision is taken, I don't want to be upset all over again. May 18th, dear Nissan, sister, it's flabbergasting. I can't believe any of it. Here's what happened. And then what's happened is that she's appealing to go to Toronto, and while she's appealing to go to Toronto, the order comes that the two children, her sister's children, Naomi and Stephen, who are under 10, must go with the other sister, Oba-san, into Slocum, and she has to go to Toronto. And in an attempt to appeal to keep them all together and get out of the province or out of the West, she's lost a connection with them. And I believe it's 18 years when they pull out of Vancouver for Slocum, and she is taken to Toronto before they see her again. That is the Aunt Emily's words. The narrator's words are far more poetic, poignant, so painful that I couldn't read through this book in one sitting. Joy Kogawa is a poet primarily before she was, this is her first novel. And the writing of this novel, I think, is as close to poetry and in some places as you'll find in a novel. Would you like to have some reaction to this part of the novel? And then, if you like, I'll go on and read some of the later as the narrator is trying to find out her story. She is reading this diary much later in the 70s. The whole book is her discovery of what really happened. She lived through it as a child, but didn't know what was happening. This diary she finds in this, the week she comes home for the funeral as well. Any reactions to this, or anything that evoked, or memories, or knowledge, or recollections?
The same thing. I've been from the Portland area, and I have talked to several people who were involved in very similar kinds of things, where racism was stirred up, and because people had to be encamped from the Portland area too, and were taken off to Montana, or there was a whole camp at Tule, California, and Northern California, and places like that.
Are any of you old enough to have been aware of the news at that time? Was it public knowledge then? Or was this as hushed up as she said it was in Canada, that there was no news from the camps?
See, I'm too young. I was a kid then, but this is all vicarious for me.
I had a friend teach this novel in Victoria, BC, a year ago, and they never got to teaching a novel because most of the people had grown up, or the older people, they'd grown up in the province. And they remembered this happening with neighbors and friends in an uncanny, eerie echo of what was happening in Germany, where people were disappearing on the street. And they hadn't much spoken of it. Marie's my age, and I was born in 44, so she was born in 42. But she says her mother, she phoned her mother after this class and said, what did happen then? And her mother said, well, didn't you know I took you to Saskatchewan? There was such a scare that they went from Vancouver Island to Saskatchewan in this period. There was so much hysteria around that. And I don't know, my question is, was it similar in the States, the same degree, the same nature, the same kind? It's hard without
document to compare to. I didn't get to know people personally. I mean, I had only just moved out here myself, but I remember how many people were mortified. There really was nothing for me to do. You know, they just pinned them up, and that just seemed so inhumane. Now, there are several ladies up here in Poland who came from Latvia. One of them was born in Latvia, and the other born when she came here. It's the same thing that they were chased out of there, from there to Germany, and from Germany to here.
My sense, and I may be wrong, maybe my ignorance of history, I do know this novel was a bombshell in Canada. This has not been dealt with very extensively in history. And again, my question is, has it been as much a part of the history and understanding? Is it just a crack that we see? It isn't something to be proud of, is it?
You know, there have been documentaries on the Japanese that have moved around, and there have been some lawsuits that I think are in the last few years of being settled in favor of the Japanese.
I think you're probably a bit ahead in terms of making it an open issue. I think there's probably some years ahead.
There's also a bill in Congress right now to provide retribution to the people who were interned.
Yes, yes.
And I'm not just sure where that is in the legislative process at this time. But
I know that there's a professor emeritus from the University of Alberta who has come down to Seattle and won a case, and I don't know if he's in Seattle for this period. He must be, because he's won a particular case on property and rights that were lost. And I think he probably left the county at this time. Would you like to hear some more? That was very much a documentary. There's more now, the fictional story, Weaving, which is certainly based on experience, but it's more the sense of a story here now happening. Would you like to get more? And I'll have to do these little explanations because it does jump forwards and back. A description of where they came to in Slocum. And the description is when she has visited with Aunt Emily many years later. At some period, she has gone there. It was an evacuation, all right, Aunt Emily said, and this was in the 50s. Just plopped here in the wilderness, and they've gone to visit to look at the town that Naomi grew up in. You were fleshed out of Vancouver, like dung drops, maggot bait. None of us, Aunt Emily said, escaped the naming. We were defined and identified by the way we were seen. A newspaper in BC headlined, "They, the Japanese, are a stench in the nostrils of the people of Canada." We were therefore relegated to the cesspools. And she names all the towns, Slocum, Bay Farm, Popoff, Lemon Creek, New Denver. We lived in tents, in bunks, in skating rinks, in abandoned hotels. Most of us lived in row upon row of two-family, three-room huts, controlled and orderly as wooden blocks. There was a tidy mind somewhere controlling us. Some families who'd gone ahead or independently had been able to find empty farmhouses to rent. In Slocum, several families lived in an abandoned bunkhouse at an old silver mine. Our own house was just a two-roomed log hut at the base of a mountain. It was shabby and sagging and overgrown with weeds when we first saw it on that spring day in 1942. And then we'll go to the irony of the game that Steve and her brother was given for Christmas that year. The Yellow Peril is a Somerville game made in Canada. It was given to my brother Stephen that Christmas, the first Christmas would be 1942. On the red and blue box cover is a picture of soldiers with bayonets and fists raised high, looking out over a sea full of burning ships and a sky full of planes, a game about war. Over a map of Japan are the words, "This game shows how a few brave defenders can withstand a very great number of enemies. There are 50 small yellow pawns inside, and 3 big blue checker kings. To be yellow in the Yellow Peril game is to be weak and small. Yellow is to be chicken. I will not be yellow. I will not cry." And that's the words of a child. She knew very early on that. In fact, all through runs a theme that she went silent through all these years and did not speak. And of course, the pathos is that she's the one that's writing the story. They almost thought she wasn't able to speak. I do know that this manuscript was sent to a novelist in Canada who, quite, I said, uncanny coincidence, is living in the town to which they were moved. How you get 2 major novelists out of one tiny town in Alberta, I don't know. But before, just in the year before this came out, she sent him a manuscript saying, "What do I do with this?" And you say what you say to any writer, you let it go when you're ready. But I should think the writing of this was a wrench, to say the least. And this is from the school there. Steve and I are walking to school that death day. My school slump, and the death day is the day she sees other boys murdering chickens. And yellow chickens, and the connection between the game, Yellow Peril, with yellow the chicken, and she sees them murdering. In a way, it is not directed at her and her brother, but she connects that ability to murder them could be turned on her and her brother, and this is the incident in which some of that fear comes out. Steve and I are walking to school, my school bag slung over my shoulder, his strapped to his back. In my bag are 2 new scribblers, one with a picture of a dog and one with 2 little girls. I have pencils, wax crayons, scissors, a QB eraser, all new in a new pencil case. And my lunch is in a rectangular metal lunch box with a diagonal slot in the lid for a small pair of ivory chopsticks. My lunch that Obasa made is 2 moist and sticky rice balls with a salty red plum in the center of each, a boiled egg to the side with a tight square of lightly boiled greens. Stephen has peanut butter sandwiches, an apple, and a thermos of soup, and all the way runs through is Stephen's quick rejection of what is Japanese. Hers is to retain and remain and seek and find what happened, and the compassion of the old aunt over the years that Stephen disappears. Already, peanut butter sandwich and no rice balls. My school bag thumps against my hips as we walk. We have just come out of the patch of woods near the missionary's place when I see 2 big boys, Percy Bauer and another boy, running down the road. Stephen sees them too and freezes. "Don't notice," he whispers, barely moving his mouth. Percy has a handful of stones and throws them down the road. When he sees us, he calls out, "Hey, Gimpy, where are you going?" And by this time, Stephen has a slightly lameness in his leg, but there's no sufficient doctor care, and I don't know what it is. "Taking your girlfriend to school," the other boy shouts. They catch up to us and begin dancing in front of Stephen, jabbing him on the shoulder. "Fight, Jap, fight. Why don't you fight, Jap, fight?" Stephen stands still as a stone. But you can hear the poet, "Stephen stands still as a stone." One of the hands is on the strap of his backpack, ready to take it off. "Come on, you gimpy Jap, come on." Stephen hands me his lunchbox. I step backwards, wanting to run away and wanting to stay with Stephen. He is taking his school bag off when we hear one of the missionaries shouting at us. She's a thin woman with light brown hair. I see her at Sunday school. "Hair, here." The voice is sharp, like an axe chopping logs into kindling. She is standing at the side of the house, her hands on her hips, her feet apart. This time the boys flee, sprinting down the road. Stephen, with his school bag dangling from one shoulder, begins walking rapidly in the opposite direction towards Bay Farm. I catch up to him and silently hand him his lunchbox. We walk together rapidly, past the Dukabor store and across the road to the open field. In the middle of the field stands the school. I find this good one. I've read this over and over and over again, but if you'd like to talk and discuss it, then you try to react with the ship sections. There's something so inevitable. They're taunting of the children. I mean, they will not escape. They've been removed from BC, but the war has just begun, has it not, for this child? It's the next 5 to 10 years she's battling this. And I'd like to read this little scene. Well, perhaps I should give you a choice. There is the scene of what happens to the parents. This is in the bathhouse when the Japanese turn on them as well, out of fear and hysteria. And it's a beautiful evocation of the way in which the Japanese bathe, the communal aspect, and all the women together, and it's their time of peace and tranquility. We did spend 2 years in Japan, 6 months in Japan 2 years ago, and one of the things I missed the most was the bathing with other women in the bathhouses. It's a traditional, ritualistic, communal rite that has no equivalent in anything I know in the West. How many of you have been in Japan? Is that more than 2 years? The baths are deep and they're hot and they're big, like swimming pools, 3 foot deep. You scrub yourself, you wash, and they watch Westerners, because Westerners sometimes don't know better. You sit in front of little spigots on little wooden stools and you scrub yourself to an inch of your life till you're soaked off and clean. And when you've and they've got these long, thin towel washcloths that you scrub and you scrub, and you watch the little children being scrubbed and they are scrubbed within an inch of their life. And then the mother or the grandmother will scrub herself, and all the time the children are playing around the feet of scrubbers. And we are watching sort of through the mirror, which is in front of you, and you're just stool, you're going to spigot your bucket in the mirror, and you can see what the other people are doing. And then you can get in the bath, and you're really rinsed clean. And the Japanese are exquisitely polite, but if you should dare, A, to go into the bath without washing, or B, with having soap on you, you'll be told. You'll know before you step in. And then there's this hours, minutes, however long you've got, to sit in the depth of the really hot, hot, hot water, up to your chin. And the children play, and the mothers talk. It's. I was going to sit and make a pun and say it's very warm. I didn't mean to do that. It's a very warm communal setting. But I think that's not as poignant as when she finds out what happened, and that's really painful. What would you like to hear? When she receives the mother's letter or the bath scene?
Is it either or?
Well, I'm looking at our time. It's 7:40. I'm afraid it is. These books are available. There's 2 left in the books that they've really been selling this week.
The mother's letter.
Mm-hmm. I think probably that's the most powerful thing we could look at. They are moved from... In 1945, they are moved from Slocum to a place called Lethbridge. And she gives her memories of that time. Okay, I'm just going to bring you up to when she gets these notes. And they're put into another shabby, insufficient shack, even worse than the previous one. Why the removal came, I don't remember exactly, but they're taken up to Lethbridge now, and they're allowed to work on sugar beet farms, but they're workers, you know, paid virtually nothing. The irony is that their lands have been confiscated, and at one time, and never returned, and this is as close as they'll come to working on the land again. There's a picture in the paper of smiling Japanese, and the sugar beet factory, the sugar beet crop is the biggest it's ever been, thanks to the Japanese who have come. It almost sounds as if atonement is trying to be made. It's 1945 now.
See, the war was over in, I think, right in the end of August in 45.
In 45.
I remember I have a daughter who's 40. She was born in 44.
Well, this, I because of the shifting back and forth, some of the transitions aren't clear. And then maybe they've been moved because the war is over and they're now allowed to work. But the conditions are appalling. The picture that she sees in her aunt's file when she opens the file in 72 is of smiling workers with credit being given for making the sugar beet crop the biggest it's ever been. And she remembers the torture, and particularly Stephen now, who's a teenager and finds it unbearable, of living in the chicken coop. It's a previous chicken coop on the back of somebody's farm, and they lived there for several years. One more quote from newspaper documentary, I think, and then I can get up to the when she hears what actually happened. Tuesday, March 16th, 1948, is a newspaper clipping that she finds that is after this period when they were in Lethbridge. Nearly 20,000 Canadian citizens will be deprived for another year of one of the fundamental rights of citizenship, the House of Commons decreed last night. They are the Canadians of Japanese origin who were expelled from British Columbia in 1941 and are still debarred from returning to their homes, 1948 right now. Led by Angus McInnes of Vancouver, CCF members made a vain but valiant effort to have the last restriction on the freedom of Japanese Canadians removed. The attempt was eloquently supported by David Crowe, Liberal Toronto, and three Liberals declared themselves in opposition to the government. They were branded, however, those that wanted to have the restrictions removed, as theorists, visionary idealists, purists, talkers of academic nonsense, weepers of crocodile tears. By a standing vote, 73-23, the House decided that for another year, no Japanese Canadian may enter British Columbia without an RCMP permit, and those now in the interior may not return to the coast. Defenders of the restrictions denied they were motivated by racial considerations. But in nearly 4 hours of increasingly bitter debate, there was no direct answer to the blunt question posed by Mr. McInnes. If the national security is no longer in danger, and you might think by 48 there would be some degree of assumption that the national security was no longer in danger, if it ever was, what is the reason for curtailing the freedom of Canadian citizens? There was even from Tom Reed this statement: as long as I have breath in my body, I will keep fighting the House of Commons to see that the heritage which belongs to Canadians should be returned to the white people. Major Perk suggested there would be crimes of revenge if the exiles were permitted to return home now. In war, he said, the innocent suffer with the guilty. There was still hatred among the white people of BC, and he thought the government was wise in giving the old sores another year to heal. And the narrator's remark is, another year? Which year should we choose for our healing? Restrictions against us were finally removed on April Fool's Day, 1949. But the old sores remain. In time, the wounds will close and the scabs drop off the healing skin. But what then? And again, she's reading some of the issues. So I'll take you to the mother, when she finally is allowed, she can remember her aunt coming with the documents and staying up late at night talking to her aunt, Aunt Emily coming with documents to the aunt she lives with. And she can hear them saying, Kodonamo, Kodonamo. And it's the beginning of a phrase which means, for the sake of the children. You won't tell, for the sake of the children. This was early 50s. And in the 60s, Aunt Emily visits again, and now it's 72. Finally, they can stay up that night. There are only two letters in the gray cardboard folder. We've had all these flashbacks, and now we're sitting there the night of the older remaining family out of Italy, and she's finally agreed to look. She's resisted. It's been prevented from her. Her uncle, on August 6, 1954, takes her up a coulee and says, "How old are you, Mary?" And she says, 18. And he says, "Too young." And she remembers him saying that. In 1972, a month before he dies, they walk to the same coulee. And he says, "It's so hard to forget." And it's late August. And then after his death in September, this is what happens. So some of the poignancy were missing because I'm not building up to it. All right, one of the letters is from, the one that begins, is from the grandmother. Naomi's mother goes with her mother to visit her mother. Naomi the narrator is now reading this from her grandmother. The letter is simply dated 1949. It was sent from somewhere in Nagasaki. There was no return address. "Though it was a time of war," Grandma writes, "what happiness that January 1945 to hear of the birth of my niece's daughter in Nagasaki." All right, the explanation of how they get to Nagasaki. "Setsuko's second child was due to be born within the month. In February, just as the American air raids in Tokyo were intensifying, mother went to help her cousin in Nagasaki." And Mary's mother is going to Nagasaki. The baby was born 3 days after she arrived. Early in March, air raids and alarms were constant day and night in Tokyo. In spite of all the dangers of travel, Grandma Kato went to Nagasaki as well to be with my mother and to help with the care of the new baby. The last day she spent with her mother and sister in Tokyo, she said they sat on the tatami and talked, remembering childhood and chestnut picking. They parted with laughter. The following night, Grandma Kato's sister, with whom she'd spent time at that time, their mother, her sister's husband, died in the B-29 bombings of March 9, 1945. "She and my mother," she writes, "were unable to talk of all the things that happened after this March bombing. The horror would surely die sooner, they felt, if they refused to speak. But the silence and the constancy of the nightmare had become unbearable for Grandma, and she hoped that by sharing them with her husband, to whom the letters were written in Canada, she would be able to extricate herself from the grip of the past. If these matters are sent away in a letter," she writes, "perhaps they will depart a little from our souls. For the burden of these words, forgive me." Mother, for her part, continued her vigil of silence. She specifically requested that Stephen and I be spared the truth, that the American bombing had killed the relatives. "In all my high school days, until we heard from Sensei that her grave had been found in Tokyo, I pictured my mother trapped in Japan by government regulations or by an alien grandmother. The letters I sent to the address in Tokyo were never answered or returned. I never knew that they were in Nagasaki. The weather was hot and humid that morning of August 9th. The air raid alerts had ended. Tomio and some other neighborhood children had gone to the ditch to play and cool off as they sometimes did. Shortly after 11 o'clock, my grandma Kato was preparing to make lunch. The baby was strapped to her back. She was bending over a bucket of water beside a large earthenware storage bin when a child in the street was heard shouting, 'Look at the parachute!' A few seconds later, there was a sudden white flash, brighter than a bolt of lightning. She had no idea what could have exploded. It was as if the entire sky were swallowed up. A moment later, she was hurled sideways by a blast. She had a sensation of floating tranquilly in a cool whiteness high above the earth. When she regained consciousness, she was slumped forward in a sitting position in a water bin. It took Grandma a long time to claw her way out of the wreckage. When she emerged, it was into a twilight formed of heavy dust and smoke that blotted out the sun. What she saw was incomprehensible. The buildings were flattened or in flames. The landmarks were gone. Beneath some wreckage, she saw first the broken arm, then the rattling body of her niece. It isn't clear from the letter, but at some point she came across Tomio. She gathered him in her arms. He was remarkably intact, his skin unburned. She had no idea where mother was, but with the two children, she began making her way towards the air raid shelter. Nearing the shelter, Grandma could see through the grayness that the entrance was clogged with bodies. She remembered then that her niece's father-in-law lived on a farm on a hillside, and she began making her way back through the burning city towards the river she would have to cross. After wandering for some time, she found a wooden water pipe dribbling a steady stream. She held Tomio's mouth to it and allowed him to drink as much as he wished, for she had heard that too much water was not good. She unstrapped the still unconscious baby from her back. She's been carrying these two children through the town across the river. Exhausted, she drank from the pipe, and gathering the two children in her arms, she looked out at the burning city and elapsed into a sleep so deep she believed she was unconscious. When she awakened, she was in the home of her sister's and her niece's relative, and the baby was being fed body water. The little boy was nowhere. Almost immediately, Grandma set off to look for the child. Next day, she returned to the area, and every day thereafter, she looked for my mother and the lost boy. One evening, when she had given up the search for the day, she sat down beside a naked woman she'd seen earlier, who was aimlessly chipping wood to make a pyre on which to cremate a dead baby. The woman was utterly disfigured. Her nose and one cheek were almost gone. Wounds covered her entire face and body. She was completely bald. As Grandma watched her, the woman gave her a vacant gaze, then let out a cry. This was my mother. The little boy was never found. Mother was taken to a hospital and was expected to die, but she survived. Mother wore bandages on her face. When they were removed, Mother felt her face with her fingers and then asked for a cloth mask. Thereafter, she would not take off her mask from morning to night. After this, what could have happened? Did they leave the relatives in Nagasaki? Where and how did they survive? When sensei, or teacher, is finished reading, this has been read aloud to them, he folds and unfolds the letter, nodding his head slowly. I put my hands around the teapot, feeling its brown warmth against my palms. My skin feels hungry for warmth, for flesh. Grandma mentioned in the letter that she saw one woman cradling a hot water bottle as if it were a baby. Sensei places the letter back in the cardboard folder and closes it with a short red string around the tab. That there is brokenness, he says quietly, that this world is brokenness, but within brokenness is the unbreakable name. How the whole earth groans till love, the unbreakable name, returns. He's the clergyman uncle who's talking. I stand up abruptly and leave the room, going into the kitchen for more hot water. When I return, Sensei is sitting with his face in his hands. Stephen is staring at the floor, his body hunched forward, motionless. He glances at me, then looks away swiftly. I sit on a stool beside him and try to concentrate on what is being said and what I have heard. I can hear Aunt Emily telling us about Mother's grave. And then Sensei stands and begins to say the Lord's Prayer. And forgive us our trespasses, forgive us our trespasses. He repeats, sighing deeply, as we forgive others. He lifts his head, looking upwards. We are powerless to forgive unless we first are forgiven. It is a high calling, my friends, the calling to forgive. But no person, no people is innocent. Therefore, we must forgive one another. I am not thinking of forgiveness. The sound of Sensei's voice grows as indistinct as the hum of distant traffic. Gradually, the room grows still, and it's as if I'm back with Uncle again, that day, listening and listening to the silent earth and the silent sky when he took me to the coulee, listening as I have done all my life. I close my eyes. Mother, mother who never wrote to me, I am listening. Assist me to hear you. And the anguish that the narrator has is that the mother, after leaving in 1941, never was able to write to her. This is the first. And in 72, then there's this beautiful, beautiful, almost hymn to mother. Silent mother, speak to me. Silent mother, you have spoken to me. Silent mother, I hear you. Almost a recreation of it, a mystical experience that at long last she knows her mother didn't abandon her by choice, which is what the child, as a child, and this runs through who in Japan was more important than I was. Why didn't she return? I think I would do just a tiny bit of that as a closing in that long. Just a little bit of the beginning. Or would you like to react? Silent mother, you do not speak or write. You do not reach through the night to enter morning, but you remain in the voicelessness. From the extremity of much dying, the only sound that reaches me now is the sigh of your remembered breath a wordless word. How shall I listen to that speech, mother? How shall I trace that wave? You are tide rushing moonward, pulling back from the shore. A raft rocks on the surface, bobbing in the dark. The water fills with flailing arms that beckon like seaweed. I sit on the raft, begging for a tide to land me safely on the sand that you draw me to the white distance, away from the blood-drugged earth. By the time this country opened its pale arms to you, it was too late. First you could not, then you chose not to come. Now you are gone. And she did have the choice finally to come before her death, but she was named to be on that mission. Tonight Aunt Emily has said a missionary found your name on a plaque of the dead. A Canadian maple tree grows there where your name stands. The tree utters its scarlet voice in the air, prayers bleeding. Its rustling leaves are fingers scratching an empty sky. There is no date on the stone. There are no photographs ever again. Do not tell Stephen and Naomi, you say. I am praying that they may never know. Martyr mother, you pilot your powerful voicelessness over the ocean and across the mountain, straight as a missile to our hut on the edge of the sugar beet field. You wish to protect us with lies, but the camouflage did not hide your cries. Beneath the hiding, I am there with you, and she's back now into her childhood, realizing where she was when this happened to her mother. Silent mother, lost in the abandoning, you do not share the horror. At first, stumbling and unaware of pain, you opened your eyes in the red mist and sheltering a dead child, you flew through the flames. Young mother at Nagasaki, am I not also there with you? In the dark, sloken night, the bright light flares in my dreaming. I hear screams and I feel the mountain breaking. Mother, I see your face, do not turn aside. No one knows the exact day that you die. Aunt Emily writes and writes and receives no replies. All that is left is your word. Do not tell the children. For the sake of the children, do not tell. And then a memory. You stand on a street corner in Vancouver in a straight silky dress and a light black coat. On your head is a wide-brimmed hat with a feather, and your black shoes have one strap and a buckle at the side. And I stand leaning into you, my dress bulging over my round baby belly. My fat arm clings to your leg. Your skirt hides half my face. Your leg is a tree trunk, and I am branch, vine, butterfly. I am joined to your limbs by right of birth, child of your flesh, leaf of your bough. But the tree is a dead tree in the middle of the prairies. I sit on its roots still as a stone. Gentle mother, we were lost together in our silences. Sensei is praying softly, a long, long prayer. Father, if your suffering is greater than ours, how great that suffering must be, he is saying. How great the helplessness, how we dare not abandon the ones who suffer, lest we again abandon you. His voice rises and falls as it did when he was praying at Grandma's funeral in Slocum. We are abandoned, but we are not abandoned. Teach us to forgive. I am thinking that for a child there is no presence without flesh. But perhaps it is because I am no longer a child, I now know my mother's presence, even though you are not here. The letters tonight are skeletons, bones only from the past. But the earth still stirs with dormant blooms. Love flows through the roots of the trees by our graves.